Not only are you one of Bob's favorite Instagram follows, you are now his favorite genre of Instagram follow.
Okay, Steve, you're taking a little bit too far here and putting words in my mouth.
But that's the premise of side shtick. Is you ask me what genre of Instagram follow I like best? I like dirty Russian airplanes, and you like shirtless, attractive gay men. I'm Steve Giordano.
I'm Bob Allen.
And this is Cockpit Casual, the podcast.
Episode two.
So we said it was going to be a weekly podcast, and we are thus far in week two living up to that.
That we are. And actually, this is, we're recording it with less than a week then.
Yeah.
Two in a week, essentially.
Exactly. It's Sunday night right now at 8:45 p.m. Eastern time. And Bob and I jumped on the phone earlier today and said, you know what, let's try to record one tonight because this week is going to be absolutely insane. There's a lot of news to talk about. I think it's a good opportunity to kind of talk about some flight planning stuff that has to do with the world events that are going on right now. We have plenty to talk about. Let's put something together. We have guests already, like, ready to come on. And I think we might have to push guests till the following week just because of how busy everything is getting here without.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the guests. I want to get some, you know, we've got, you know, some really interesting, cool people in the pipeline. And I want to get to that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there's a few current events going on right now that are all over the news that we want to talk about because it's affecting our operation a little bit.
It is. I mean, certainly from a planning perspective. So just a couple of housekeeping notes. First and foremost, thank you everybody for the questions that you've sent in. We have a ton and I love it. We're not going to be able to probably get to them all. We'll see how it goes. If I don't get to all of them, I'll get to most of them tonight. I wanted to just keep it to a couple, but since we're not doing a guest this week, I think we can tackle some questions. I think that would be great.
Yeah.
And beyond that, I also want to thank everybody for watching. It's been very well received. Thousands of downloads already. You guys are awesome. We love our audience. You guys, seriously,
absolutely,
man, you guys are awesome.
All positive stuff. And I was kind of nervous there on that first episode. I wasn't really sure how it was going to sound to people. I know how it sounds to you and I, Steve. This is our normal conversation. And I mean, this is us talking. Glad some other people find it interesting.
Yeah. So, and the a lot of suggestions, really good stuff. Yes. I know the camera angles were terrible last time. I think we're parallel now. Are we?
Yeah.
Parallel?
I think I'm still taller than you, right?
Yeah. For those that are watching this on YouTube, you know, the video feed has some floating heads like podcast style, and my camera was far away. Bob's was perfect. I looked like small and in the corner, and Bob was large and in charge, and it just was not visually pleasing. So I bought a new webcam, so I'm excited about that. And then I got a new mic stand. I got the mic a little closer so that the sound is going to be better. So anyway, thanks for your suggestions. Somebody was complaining about my mirror back there that it was distracting. I did not move that yet.
A lot of comments on the amp. I'll have to put some of my other amps back here over time.
Yes. Yes. So anyway, let's get into it. So why are we recording this on a Sunday night? Well, because, we talked about last week how dead it's been, how slow everything has been. And all of a sudden kind of a switch flipped. We had a couple of these trips that we had lined up were kind of scheduled to go. I think we had like two or three scheduled in the next couple of weeks. All of a sudden, we're looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 trips that are going to go in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And as you guys probably know through some of our social media conversations, we can't always give all the details, especially in advance. After the fact, we can generally talk about trips. We can often film them and stuff like that. We can't give a lot of information on a couple of the major trips we have going. So I apologize for that. I know that that's not great. But it's just kind of the nature of this business. We have to respect our clients' confidentiality. But I will say, of the trips that we have going, we have two 737 NGs. We have a 757, an A330, an ATR 72600, a Dash 8-300. So that's seven aircraft. Tomorrow I'm doing a domestic trip. I can talk about that one. I'm going to Greenwood, Mississippi. Greenwood Lake, is it called?
No, it's just Greenwood. Greenwood, Mississippi. KGWO.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know that I've been there. Bob and I both have trips tomorrow. So Bob's flying a 757 demo, and I am flying a domestic 737 ferry with Pat Lewis.
Yeah. So, just to jump in there for people that don't know what makes us so insane is part of the fact is that we have nothing going on for sometimes 2 or 3 weeks, and we have all of these trips that are in motion are getting delayed, trips that pop up, and somehow they all go like either on the same day or in the same week. So it makes it very difficult to staff that many trips, not to mention the stress it puts on our dispatch team. But it's inevitable. It's been that way for decades. I don't know what in the universe drives that, but
it's the fairy gods.
Common.
You'll hear us mention it's something that we talk about all the time, the fairy gods. And the fairy gods, you know, it's all scripted, I'm telling you. And the two long hauls that we have going, Bob and I both wanted to do both of these trips, and I really wanted to do one of these trips, if not both of them, with Bob. But I want to bring the cameras, and I haven't filmed the Bob and I trip, you know, completely in quite a while. I want some more cockpit casual material, and the whole plan has been the two of us getting on one of these long hauls. Well, now it looks very, very, very convincingly that it's going to be us separating once again.
Because they're going to go within days of each other. I'm positive of that.
I think I'm going to end up going to China from the U.S., and I think Bob is going to end up going to Uzbekistan. Is that the one that you were thinking about doing?
Yeah, I think I'm going to end up in Uzbekistan. So, north of all of the stuff going on.
Not that far north of all of it.
No, not far north at all.
So actually, Bob and I went to Tashkent back late last year, and I have great footage of it. And that's actually going to be the next cockpit casual that I'm working on, is that Tashkent trip. So
yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, we did all kinds of cool stuff on the ground there, and I got awesome footage. We went to like some markets, and we just wandered around. They have a really cool subway system, believe it or not. We'll talk about that another time, but wanted to go back to Tashkent with Bob.
I know. It would have been cool to go back. You know, I don't know. Who knows? I mean, look, I'm not to the fairy gods, I'm not complaining. I mean, send us trips. I'm not complaining about having trips.
Me either.
I'm just,
me either.
I'm just complaining.
At the end of the day, Bob, we still may fly them together because one might delay 2 weeks and one might, who knows?
Exactly.
Like, we're planning on being gone again within the next 7 days, both on long hauls. The reality is, maybe neither of us will be.
Running this company is like you put a puzzle together every day, and you're almost finished with it. It's almost complete, and then somebody comes and just knocks all of the pieces off the table, and you got to start over. It's just like that, day after day.
It really is the perfect analogy because it's not an easy puzzle either. It's like one of those jigsaw puzzles that's one solid color. And you just have to identify the pieces by like the world's most difficult jigsaw puzzle. Like it gets like that sometimes.
And sometimes you just have to jam pieces together that don't fit.
Yeah, you just tape them. So anyway, busy couple of weeks. Like you said, Uzbekistan, I'll be, you know, we had a China trip. We've got a Prague to Italy trip. We have one of the turboprops is going from the States to Lagos, Nigeria. Neither of us are going to do that one. Another turboprop is Canada down to Vero Beach. So anyway, lots of stuff on tap, lots of stuff on the horizon. But again,
well, it depends on what happens in the world, right?
It definitely does, which takes us right into current events. So this weekend, I'm sure you all are well aware, an armed conflict has started in Iran. We're not going to get political on this show. We're not going to talk about anything other than how this affects aviation. I really have no comments. I honestly haven't even formed an opinion on it as of right now. I don't feel qualified to really comment on the, this is right, this is wrong. Forget all that right now. This yeah. is major, and it is going to affect things in the aviation business. It's already affecting things in the aviation business. So from all the reports I'm seeing, there's been a lot of airstrikes, U.S. and Israeli military conducting airstrikes with drones and manned aircraft potentially on targets in Iran. And then Iran has been launching ballistic missiles to neighboring countries and cities, Dubai, Bahrain,
everybody,
Qatar.
It's crazy. I mean, it's pretty wild watching, Dubai get hit, or Abu Dhabi, where we spent a lot of time in those places. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Burj Khalifa, we've been in. I mean, we've been in a restaurant there. It's crazy. Obviously, we are praying and hoping for, for the best for all the people involved, all the civilians involved, just yeah. in harm's way over there. And
yeah, hopefully it's over quick.
Yeah. If you are over there in that part of the world, be safe. Be vigilant. Try to keep yourself out of harm's way. I mean, we've been in some pretty scary places,
Yeah.
And it's not a good feeling. It really isn't. And I having spent so much, I mean, we could have very well been in any of those cities this week.
Easily.
We aren't. The biggest impact I'm seeing right now to the public comes with the closures of the Dubai airport primarily. And I believe Qatar's, Doha airport is shut down as well. Do you know if that's the case?
I think they all are. I think that whole Middle Eastern, Gulf region, I think everything's closed there.
Yeah. All the airports. For the people that are watching on YouTube, I'm going to pull up some maps, and we're going to kind of talk about the region a little bit as we start talking about routings. And you'll really see, that whole Gulf region. You have Iran to the north of the Persian Gulf, and you have the UAE and Bahrain and Qatar and Muscat or Oman, all kind of along the southern part. And you go inward and you have, Kuwait, and then eventually Iraq, and then, like I said, Iran to the north. So everything, kind of all the land areas that circle the Persian Gulf, they have major ports and major cities right along the water there. And those are that area, that little oval of cities around the Persian Gulf as the centerpiece, are all affected by this right now. Qatar Airways, Emirates, Etihad. If I'm sure you know this, as the traveling public, they are the major players in hub and spoke international travel worldwide, and they have been for a number of years, and for good reason. The best business and first class, even coach, from what I hear, not that I would know, seats in the world for long haul travel are on these Middle Eastern carriers. They just are. They're just, it's a wonderful product.
Great service, top-notch service. I mean, new airplanes, newer interiors. I mean, and it's usually a better price than what I would call legacy carriers around the world.
Yeah. There's not a single airline in the United States that can come anywhere close to the business class or first class experience in Qatar, Emirates, Etihad, first or business class. It can't be beat. And it's changed the way people travel long distance. A lot of times nowadays, if I'm going to Asia, I'll fly one of the Middle Eastern carriers. I can leave out of New York. It's one stop. It's an easy connect to anywhere I'm going in Southeast Asia, Africa. Unless I'm going to South America, I can pretty much always take a Middle Eastern carrier.
Yeah, they're in the perfect position for a really long, ultra long haul hub and spoke type of a system worldwide. They're in the perfect region for that.
Yeah. And now with the airports closed and the flights canceled, there are people, no doubt, either unable to get to where they need to be or stuck where they are not supposed to be anymore, trying to get home and trying to make alternate plans. And, anything, when there's mass cancellations anywhere throughout the airline industry, there is an accordion effect, bunches up, and then, every other option becomes sold out, and then people end up just stuck and trying to get home any way possible. And that's going on big time right now with the closure of these airlines.
Yeah, I just recently saw on, I don't know if it was on Instagram or X, today there was a ferry crew. It was like a BizJet ferry crew that delivered an airplane to India or somewhere. And they were supposed to come back on one of the Middle Eastern carriers. It's canceled. They're stuck wherever they're at. They're having a hard time even finding flights, you know, to get back home. And they were just kind of putting the word out, hey, if you've got an empty, if you're a corporate airplane or a charter with an empty leg, you know, here we are. Can you help us out?
Right now, this has all basically just happened. It's been the weekend. The fallout isn't even really fully realized yet. So we're going to learn a lot more this week. And so I think for the next pod, we'll have a lot more in the way of update as to how things are going with that. If you're out there traveling or planning to travel, you know, good luck. it's definitely not going to be a fun week to do long haul travel that requires even stuff that isn't going through the Middle East is liable to be affected just by the cancellations and reroutes of other people. So let's talk about how this could potentially affect our operation. So we are also quite fortunate that none of the trips that we have on the schedule are passing through the Middle East corridor right now. And that's also pretty unusual. The Middle East corridor, if you watched the last Cockpit Casual, when we were bringing the airplane out of Harbin, China, the A319, we stopped in Muscat, and we ended up in the UK. Any transit between Western Europe, Eastern, all of Europe, and pretty much all of Asia, Southeast Asia, China, that traffic all these days passes through the Middle East corridor. And when I say the Middle East corridor, what I mean is Saudi Arabia, the Persian Gulf, you know, all the way to like the Gulf of Oman to Cairo, like the Sinai Peninsula, like everything within that area is where a tremendous amount of traffic passes through. And that's where we almost always transit, routing between Europe and Asia. And we just don't have any airplanes going between Europe and Asia this week. So that's why we're not there. That's not to say that we're not going to have those type of trips come up in the next days, weeks. Sometimes we find out about a trip and we're in airborne 4 days, 3 days later, right? So right now we don't have anything going there, but it doesn't take much for a trip to pop up where we are going to be dealing with that region. Yeah. So as soon as that happened, you know, we got on the horn with our planning and dispatch team, and we started working out alternatives. And that's something that we always try to do whenever there's an event. Unfortunately, these events have been way more common over the last couple of years.
For sure.
And we have to figure out and get an idea of what we're going to do ahead of time so that we can appropriately plan trips as they come in, and we need to quote them and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. We're always staying on top of the, you know, world situations and, you know, at least having it in the back of our minds, you know, in the back of our minds as a company, to where we get with our dispatchers, our planners. And, like Steve said, we plan some alternate routes based on what's going on in the world or what we think could happen. Because things change fast, and you know, we could have an airplane that's heading out, you know, like you said, through that Middle East corridor, and we have to change very quickly to a more northern routing, which is also a viable routing. And if you watch Flight Radar 24, our friends at Flight Radar 24, we know those guys pretty well. You'll see where all of the airplanes are being routed between Asia and Europe right now.
So what I've done here is I've pulled up a Google Earth, and a reason being is it'll kind of help our YouTube listeners kind of understand what we're talking about. So I've zoomed in right now kind of on Iran, and Iran is very large. So first of all, I mean, it's Iran is almost as large as India. I mean, it's a very, very physically large country. And the way it's situated, you know, so we have Saudi Arabia to the south. You have the Persian Gulf. Here's that oval that I was talking about right here in the, is my arrow on the screen there, Bob?
Yeah. Yep. I see.
Okay. Okay. So yeah. So on the west, you have Iraq, Basra, Kuwait down here, kind of in the, on the western, southwestern corner. You have Bahrain, which is this little tiny little peninsula next to Qatar, which is a larger peninsula in the southern part. And then you have the United Arab Emirates up along the southeastern part of the Persian Gulf, right? But that's all Iran to the north. That is all Iran. And then you have Dubai on the coast. You have Abu Dhabi just to the south of Dubai along the coast. It's about an hour drive for perspective between Abu Dhabi and Dubai. And then you have Oman to the east of the UAE, Muscat on the northern coast, the northern shore of Oman, the Gulf of Oman. And then this is the Strait of Hormuz here, which is, you'll hear that all over the news. It's a major shipping channel where ships, primarily oil tankers coming out of, you know, the oil fields in the UAE and Qatar and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iran fill up and, you know, transit the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman, and into the Arabian Sea, and then ultimately into the Indian Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, or wherever the ships are going from there, or back around the other direction through the Suez Canal and then through the Mediterranean. So it's a major shipping port, and that's something else that we can talk about. I mean, the impact of this conflict is going to have very far-reaching effects with regard to the cost of oil.
Yeah, now you got this big bottleneck there of ships. Well, the ships are not able to even get insurance right now. The ships are just like, well, we're just going to sit here. Of course, then they're sitting ducks. The risk is high. And so now you have all this oil that's not moving out of that region to refineries. And of course, what happens? The price of oil is probably going to go up. I think it's, as we speak right now, it's already up 5% at the open.
Yeah. There's oil being produced all over the place, but the bulk of the oil that we're consuming is coming out of this region. So obviously that's not going to bode well either for the aviation industry. So let's talk routings for a minute here. You may notice, and I noticed there's a couple of questions regarding the why do we route through Cairo? One of the major reasons we choose any stops in this business and repeatedly go to them, we've been going to Muscat lately. The reason that we go to stick to the same places is predictability, ease, costs, and just knowing that we're going to be able to get in and out of there on short notice without like a tremendous amount of planning and permitting. Whenever you fly Part 91 the way that we do, we have to get overflight permits, landing permits, departure permits, slots, different overflight permissions. We have to send aircraft documents and so on and so forth. The places that we go for the most part are the places that minimize the time and cost of all those items. And that's why we generally go to Cairo.
And yeah, and not to mention just the business side of it, where we have credit established in most of those places. So it's not like we got to go carry a bunch of cash or deal with, you know, paying. They're essentially billing us, stop in, do our thing, and then they send us a bill.
And we've been going to Cairo for years. It's a decent overnight. They take good care of us there. It's just an easy place to go. And fuel seems to be cheap. Somebody mentioned Oman. You know, we go into Oman. We've delivered plenty of aircraft to Oman. There's a large MRO there that we've used plenty of times. It's just paperwork-wise, they need a lot more time to process the inbound and outbound permit paperwork. Same thing with Cyprus. Same thing with Israel. I mean, Israel's one of the more difficult places to get in and out of, just from a security perspective. You can't fly in there from anywhere. There's only certain designated cities.
Yeah, we would not even consider stopping in Israel for a fuel stop. They probably wouldn't let us anyway, actually.
Yeah. We're in and out of Tel Aviv. I wouldn't say often, but it happens, and it's a huge process. And there's pre-clearances required. I mean, they take security very, very, very seriously there. So that's why we go to Cairo. And then after landing in Cairo, let's say we're going toward Asia from Europe, our routing is essentially through the middle of Saudi Arabia, we go over the Sinai Peninsula, and then we transit like the center of Saudi Arabia, but then work our way toward the northern part. So we usually are just south of Qatar. Sometimes we're right over Qatar, Bahrain. We talk to Bahrain radar, Doha radar. We talk to Dubai, So as of right now, this airspace is closed, and our dispatch and planning team says that if we need to transit out of this region, we will just take a more southerly route in Saudi Arabia over central and southern Oman. Of course, we're not going to overfly Yemen, but we would overfly essentially Riyadh and then like central Oman. And then from there, you know, we could either make somewhere in India, we can make the Maldives, we can make Sri Lanka, Karachi. I mean, there's a lot of options once we get through here. So as of right now, our plan is to route south. However, if we're going to China, our dispatch has a contingency plan that has us going north. So that's through Turkey, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Baku, across the Caspian Sea, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and then into Western China from there.
And that's not due to this conflict. That's mostly due, that's the routing that's been for the last couple of years because of the Ukrainian conflict and Russia situation.
You know, these reroutes, there's a lot of things that we need to consider when we're determining these reroutes, not necessarily just airspace restrictions, but, you know, there are variables that go into all of our route selection. And it basically, it's an example of the puzzle being knocked off the table and having to get put back together. You have, you know, you quote a trip sometimes 2 to 3 months in advance, and there are some variables. Fuel prices change every week. Airfares change regularly. There are plenty of things that can change over the normal course of business, but the things that we don't plan on changing are handling costs and fuel prices that are more significant than market fluctuations. So like if you're buying fuel in Cairo at $2.85 a gallon, if all of a sudden you have to, for some reason, due to a reroute, buy gas in Sofia, you know, you could be looking at $5.50 a gallon. So that significantly impacts the cost of a trip.
Yeah. So you know, one other thing to add to that, that comes into this whole equation is the permit time. The time it takes for us to get approval to overfly a country. Sometimes we change routing or select a certain routing based on we're not going to get a ferry permit from whatever controlling agency is issuing it. Maybe the day before the flight, maybe two days, maybe 3 days. Well, some of these places require 7 days notice before we can overfly. And you know, we're under pressure from the companies that we're flying for to get that airplane out as soon as possible. A lot of times they have what's called a maintenance slot or a paint slot. They have a certain date that they have to get that airplane into the maintenance hangar wherever we're taking it. And they'll be penalized or possibly lose that maintenance slot or severely delayed in getting that maintenance if we don't get it there on that day. So we're always under a lot of pressure to move as quickly as possible. So much of our routing is based on that.
Yeah. And also there's not like a standard process for applying for permits. There's not a standard set of documents that each country asks for. I mean, there are the key items that are standard. You always have to provide a certificate of registration, a certificate of airworthiness, or a special airworthiness certificate, whether that be a PTF or an SFP. You always have to provide a certificate of insurance and a radio license. But some countries require we submit, you know, the aircraft return to service or deregistration record or the dirty fingerprints, the DFPs, like what has been touched on the aircraft during maintenance. They want to evaluate, especially if the aircraft is operating on a special ferry permit, like an SFP or a PTF, as they call it from some jurisdictions.
It's a permit to fly.
Yeah, exactly. A permit to fly. They want to know what is not airworthy in the traditional sense on the aircraft that are overflying their airspace. Certain countries require that, and certain countries don't. And certain countries have just one person that reviews all these things. Others have a process where it has to go from desk to desk and get a stamp from the military and a stamp from the Civil Aviation Authority and a stamp from the handler. And like, each one of these things might take a full day. Like I visually imagine like some guy at a desk, you know, with like a stack of papers, and he like pulls one, looks at it, stamps it.
It's got a big rubber stamp.
Yeah. I don't know what it looks like in real life, but I know that it's It's not a transparent process. It's also not infrequent for us to submit a permit, have it get rejected 2 days later, and have them ask for like six other documents. And now we're scrambling to go to the client and hey, we need, some sort of...
And as simple as like, they want different language on the insurance document. I mean, it's like, what? Like, we have insurance. I mean, why? Well, we want it in our format. We want it to say this. Sometimes they say, we want that insurance document converted to our language, not in English. We want it in whatever.
Turkey has their own format that every certificate of insurance has to be converted to by the actual insurance underwriter. So they have to send the COI back to their insurance agent and have it redrafted in a specific format in both English and in Turkish.
Yeah. And we have to use stamps on a lot of the signatures. A lot of signatures on documents around the world have to have a stamp, a signature, and like a stamp across the signature.
Yeah. So if there's no stamp, it's rejected.
Yeah. Then it's not legit in their eyes.
So I mean, the whole purpose of this, you know, this all comes back to complex permitting processes. If we can go to places where we know what they want and we know what they're going to accept and we know what they're sensitive to, we're going to go to that same place every time. We're going to overfly that same country every time because we know we can get it done quickly. And, you know, from a customer's perspective, it looks like, hey, you guys said you're going to, you know, you need 3 days notice. And now here we are. Why can't we go? Well, sir, because it's Sunday and they're not open.
Yeah, it's like, do you guys know what you're doing? Like, yeah. Have you ever done this before? Like, well, you guys are amateurs.
I wanted to just kind of pose one scenario, which might be disastrous for us. If this conflict ends up causing a closure in Saudi Arabia, as I said before, our path generally goes through the Persian Gulf, which is now off limits. Now the alternative is to go through Saudi Arabia, going to Europe or going from Asia to basically anywhere on this side of the globe. The alternative is going to have to be to go south to Mombasa, Kenya. That's kind of our workaround. It would mean instead of going through the Middle East, we'd have to go most likely to Colombo, Sri Lanka for fuel and stop in. Potentially, we can make it from Colombo to Mombasa. If not, we'd have to stop in the Maldives, in Male, and then Mombasa. And then we'd have to work our way north through Ethiopia and cross the Red Sea south of Saudi Arabia if we can get into that corridor there. So that would mean coming way, way south to get around Saudi Arabia. That would be massively problematic. And God forbid we actually have to, if this area around Egypt and the Red Sea is closed, now we're going to have to start looking at coming across Africa. And I mentioned another conflict that's been a problem. We had a few aircraft going from Dubai down to Johannesburg, South Africa last year. And that all happened right when the Sudan and South Sudan conflict kicked off. So that closed off the airspace to Sudan and South Sudan. And as you know, as of the last year, we can no longer overfly Chad, Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, Libya. So there's effectively a wall now in Africa. You have this whole northern central part of Africa that we can't overfly. So if we can't make it up through, you know, the Red Sea, coming from Kenya, Ethiopia, which is our only option, I don't know what we're going to do. I think we're going to have to, I mean, I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
No, I don't think the airlines do either because they're in the same boat.
Yeah. We can overfly the DRC. We can go over to Cameroon, Nigeria, maybe Sierra Leone and up West Africa. I don't know. It's kind of a nightmare scenario, to be honest. Really? So if things progress to the point where we can't overfly Saudi Arabia, that's going to be very, very tricky on that East-West corridor.
Yeah, well, let's hope that scenario does not happen.
Let's for sure hope that. Okay. So we're going to take a break for a second, and then when we come back, side shtick.
Oh boy, lighten things up. We are back.
What do you have for side shtick tonight?
Man, I don't know. After all that conversation, can we get light here? Can we get Can we get back to being us?
Well, I think we need to.
Yeah, for sure. Let's take away all the world's problems, put them out of your head, and think about this. So, Steve, here's a question that I'm going to throw at you. And I'm curious to see what you say.
Okay.
So what type of Instagram pilot, let's say, do you love out of these three categories?
Okay.
Understand? I want to know which one is the one that you like the best.
What Instagram content do I like the best?
Yeah. The Instagram type of influencer, let's say.
Okay.
Do you like the Instagram motivational pilot type account, or do you like the career advice, training advice type influencer that's also like, you know, they usually you're selling like a course or something? Or do you like the kind of like old school pilot that talks about how things used to be and how much better aviation was?
Okay. I first of all, I don't follow aviation content on Instagram. Okay.
Okay. Well,
so my Instagram feed is dogs mostly. It's mostly puppies and dogs.
Okay. But I'm going to say, I know that you've seen some of these influencer types.
Yes. And I've seen them. I've seen them. In fact, I send them to you via DM and laugh at them sometimes. I'm going to choose option C. I like the old school. So I will say I do follow a few aviation accounts on Instagram, and my absolute favorite to follow is Sergey IL-76. I don't know if that's exactly his name. Do you follow that one?
I don't think so. I'm not familiar with that.
Sir, oh my God. This is the best aviation account on Instagram, according to me.
So what is it about? What's the...
All right. Sergio IL-76. I made him Russian and he's not even Russian. Sergio_IL_76 is an IL-76 pilot
that shoots like
cockpit casual quality video in an IL-76.
Oh man, that is way cool. I've got to check that out. I haven't seen that.
I don't know how you haven't looked at that. I mean, like, look, can I show you his content here?
Yeah.
It's backwards, huh?
No.
You got to look at this guy's stuff.
Oh man.
This is, first of all, that airplane is one of the coolest, dirtiest, biggest, ugliest airplanes, which is just, I mean, it blows black smoke out the back. This dude, his feed is well worth watching. He should have a gazillion followers. I don't know anything about Sergio personally. I'd love to have him on the show. So that's the answer. The other guys, man, there's some guy that's always got his shirt off. Who's that?
Okay, so that's Pilot Shapiro. And I knew you were going to go there.
He's a fellow Jew, so I mean, I probably like him.
Well, yeah, I think you would, honestly. So I find him interesting.
Shirtless guys.
Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But I've actually DM'd back and forth with him. Not about like shirt.
Yeah.
No. So, you know, he's interesting because, okay, you know, everybody makes fun of him. Everybody's like, oh, he's so cringy, blah, blah, blah. And he's like always putting these like motivational type of content out there. Very positive stuff. And he just gets, just beaten to death for doing it.
Well, he does it with his shirt off, Bob. I mean, that's why. I mean, he's muscular. Most pilots look like me, like, you know, out of shape.
Okay, but so you know,
we're jealous. We don't want to be reminded how fat and disgusting we are.
Okay, I agree. So he did continue on with introducing his boyfriend. So
okay,
like he came out, introduced his boyfriend. He's very happy in the situation that he is, And I'm like, hey, that, you know, I mean, for a pilot to, you know, number one, go out there and be positive and not, you know, and not stop doing it from just getting beat to death by all the, you know, by all the cynic pilots out there.
Bob, it makes it significantly, I didn't realize that he was gay, and it makes it a lot more acceptable, in my opinion, to be honest.
I agree. And actually, that's why I wanted to bring that up to you, because I don't think you watched his content long enough to actually see that. Because, I mean, I respect that somebody would have something like that in this aviation world would be brave enough to put that out there to the world. Yeah. I'm like, that takes a lot of balls.
It does. All right, Shapiro, I like you, buddy. I you know, it's okay that your body is much more attractive than mine. I'll still follow you. It's all good, I guess.
There you go, Pilot Shapiro. I've sold you on another one.
Not only Pilot Shapiro, are you one of Bob's favorite Instagram follows? You are now his favorite genre of Instagram follow.
Okay, Steve, you're taking a little bit too far here and putting words in my mouth.
That's the premise of Side Shtick. Is you ask me what genre of Instagram follow I like best? I like dirty Russian airplanes, and you like shirtless, attractive gay men.
Okay, let's go on to that next. Okay, that's two of them. But now there's also the pilot influencer, the training, you know, influencer. The influencer that's, you know, a regional pilot talking about, you know, their career and how they got there and what the daily life is.
Yeah.
A lot of them get a lot of flack for supposedly being cringe or whatever. What is that? Oh, 7 minutes. Oh, no. Okay.
That's 7 minutes, man.
Oh,
we can't
my
talk
gosh.
About it. Are we going to extend it? Should we extend it? We still can't find our groove with Side Shtick, man.
I know. So anyway, I just want to say, here's my take on it. I like those first two categories. I really like these people that are putting a positive message out there. I like people who are helping other people. There's Pilot Ava Bell. She actually has a course on passing check rides and stuff. She puts a lot of time into it, but it puts an enormous amount of stuff online. Jen Big Energy is her Instagram. She also puts a lot of stuff out there for, you know, trying to help people with training, trying to help people with, you know, check rides and getting through all of that stuff. I think it's really cool. I mean, if I was a, you know, an up and coming pilot, I would love all that stuff. So I like that they're trying to help the aviation community in good ways, and it's all positive stuff. However, who's the other guy? Boomer Pilot?
Man, you are invested. You are invested. You know all these guys.
I do. Because people
it's
forward
good thing you're
me.
In charge of booking the guests.
People forward me this stuff all the time. Angry Boomer Pilot. Have you seen? No. He's an expat flying for, I don't know if it's an Asian airline or a Middle Eastern or an Indian airline, but it's his stuff. And it's all stuff that I can relate to from, you know, expat flying and being an old guy flying with, you know, young co-pilots and stuff.
Yeah.
It's hilarious stuff.
Oh my God. Well, look, man, I to put a cap on Side Shtick here, the bottom line is you like very positive, uplifting content because you're a positive and uplifting guy. I am a cynical curmudgeon and it's just who I am. And that's why I look at dogs on Instagram and puppies because it makes me happy. That makes me happy. Like people make me sick. Except Pilot Shapiro, I do like. I like him now. Now that I know more about his bravery.
All right,
exposing his nipples.
It makes you want to go work out now, don't it?
No, man.
Okay, no. We're gonna do a cockpit casual podcast with our shirts off one of these days.
Oh God.
If we'll get Pilot Shapiro on here, we'll all be shirtless.
Okay. Deal.
I'm kind of a sorry really I said that want, now.
All right, we're double the amount of time allotted.
Oh my
Side
God,
Shtick,
we're 10 minutes now. Okay.
Okay. All right. We're going to go into listener questions. Okay, guys. So first of all, the response was awesome. Keep it coming. The questions are great. There's a bunch of audio questions. There's a bunch of video questions. Let's go through some. If I didn't get to you this week, I've seen them all and I will get to you, and I'm not just shelving these and you don't have to resubmit. Like, if I didn't read yours, I'll get to it eventually. I'm going to get to all of them eventually, but the ones that we're going to get to today, we're going to get to today. So this one's from a guy named Jamie. He sent us a video and I'm going to play it. I think Jamie is from the UK based on his accent. What does Jamie have to say?
Hello, Captain Bob and Steve. I'm Jamie. I'm an aviation enthusiast, and my favorite aircraft is the Boeing 757. This right here is the throttle quadrant off of Condor 757s when they got strips of parts. And one of my biggest questions with the 757 is, what does the CRS selector mode on the MCP do, and the one by the iOS? So when you tune your iOS, you've got a section next to it with CRS. Is that just the course that's displayed in the FMC? And is it like the runway heading, or is it something else? I do also have a 757 yoke just down there.
Oh my God, this is wild.
He's got some serious stuff, man.
How do you get that
there
stuff?
There I am.
Casual. And just love seeing you and Captain Bob together doing all these ferry flights. And just seeing the world from your perspective.
All right, Jamie. First of all, respect. You have a 757 throttle quadrant, and that is awesome. Let's cover your questions real quick. These are easy ones. Okay, so CRS course. Yes, sir. It means course. There are two different selectors. So on the MCP, and this is a pet peeve of mine, by the way. Why does every aircraft manufacturer have different names for different, for the same components?
Right? Exactly.
So on a Boeing, it's called the MCP. The MCP would be the mode control panel. It's on the glare shield. So it's above the main panel in the front and it's below the windows. It's the panel that has the controls for all the auto, you know, the autopilot, the auto throttles, heading bug, nav, all that. That's the MCP. On the 75 and 76, there is a little nav radio kind of section on either side. The captain has one, the FO has one, and there's frequency and course. CRS is course. The main PFD, primary flight display, right, is, you know, has a horizon and a flight director on it. And then down below, there's another display, which is your nav display. And most of the time we have it in map. And in map mode, you can see each waypoint, you can see turns in the course and changes, you can overlay the weather. However, there are two different reversionary modes on that map. One of them is called ROSE, and one of them is called ARC. And in ROSE, you get a full HSI, horizontal situation indicator, which is a compass card with, you know, an HS, I don't know, what's the other word? It's a needle with like a center point that moves in and out, just like a traditional way that we navigate with VORs. So what you do when you're turning the course knob on the MCP, you're just rotating the bezel of the, not the bezel, the actual HSI needle, like it was a traditional six-pack HSI instrument. You can track a VOR using an HSI by adjusting the course on that. Bob, why don't you talk about ILSs? Because ILSs are different on the 7576.
Yeah, so the ILS frequency actually has to be dialed in, the frequency on the center control panel.
On the center console.
On the center console. It's a separate radio head for ILS frequencies. It's not the same radio head as your VOR, as Steve explained, which is up on the MCP. So you put your ILS frequency in that radio head that's on the center control panel.
Here it is over here. I have it ready. So this is the center control panel, the 757. Right here is another another radio control head. So this side is frequency, FRQ. This side is F course. That stands for front course. So you dial in the front course of the localizer. If you're shooting a back course, you dial in for the front course that you want to travel. So you're not going to put in the opposite. You're going to put in the front course all the time. That's why it differentiates here. And then when you're not shooting an ILS, this is what we call, we park it. You take it to the point where you can take it one click beyond the lowest frequency and the whole thing just disappears.
Or it shows dashes or disappears.
Right. So the one on the MCP is only for VORs, and the one on the center pedestal is for localizers and ILSs. So that answers the question. Hopefully. Good questions. And congrats on having you're a heck of an enthusiast, man.
Yeah, where did you get that? Curious.
He can't answer, but I'm sure he'll tell us. Okay, let's hear from Scott. I will share. Sorry, this whole process takes a long time. All right.
Wait, what's going on here?
Yes.
My name is Scott Maeslish. I enjoy watching your show. And my son just got his first type rating in a G4. So I'm excited for him to be flying. I've been an av geek my entire life. But my question for you is, when you pick up a plane from somebody that you may not, have a lot of experience with flying it for, how do you vet the maintenance, logs, books, can they be fraudulent? How do you know what you're flying is safe? As I asked this question on watching Cockpit Casual, I'm on Couch Casual. So enjoying your show, just ran across tonight. Hope you answer my question.
All right.
Oh, very cool.
So I'm going to let Bob answer this question. But first, I would like to say that now we know what it's like to be in bed with Scott.
on a furry pillow.
Yes. We're very intimate with Scott.
It looks very comfortable, actually.
Listeners. Yeah.
Yeah.
Scott, thanks for the question. That's a good one. We get asked this all the time, why I chose it. So go ahead, Bob. Explain.
Yeah, good question. Yeah. So the simplest answer is the aircraft go through what they call a return to service check. So there's a process to where an aircraft, before we move it, there's a technical team that checks the airplane. They check the air records to make sure that things, are up to date, things that are not up to date. We determine if we can fly the airplane with them out of date, a check or whatever. Then there's a process of taking the airplane like out of storage or whatever the situation is. There's what they call a return to service check. That check is completed before we get the FAA involved, who is then going to be presented with all of this documentation that shows that the airplane is safe for flight, not airworthy, but is safe for the intended flight. And that is words that we actually use in our line of work. So once that happens, then the FAA issues essentially a ferry permit, and then we can, take it off. And at that point, I feel safe flying the airplane.
Yeah. The simplest answer to this is always, there is never a situation where we show up to an aircraft to a whole lot of unknowns, and then the dispatch of that aircraft becomes dependent upon decisions that we make. We are pretty good pilots, and we're even pretty good, I wouldn't say engineers or mechanics, but pretty good
at assessing,
but not good enough to where we would trust ourselves in doing that. There's just too much. There's too many systems. There's too much to look at, right? So every time an airplane flies with us behind the yoke, there's an inspection process. There is a regulatory process where like the Civil Aviation Authority that is responsible for that aircraft has to sign off on it being airworthy.
Yeah. And one step further is that most of the time, the people that we're involved with that airplane are people that we've been friends with for decades. So it's a very small niche industry. We all work together. We usually know who's been inspecting that airplane or who's been responsible as like a project manager over it. And most of those guys, they will tell me, they'll look like, I am not going to put you in a bad airplane. That, you know, we're friends. They're not going to put me in danger. And I have a lot of trust in the things that they tell me.
100%. Lots of respect for those guys too. Yeah. Okay. Got another video question here from Lewis. Lewis is in a 737 and.
What's up, Bob and Steve? Just finished listening to the first episode of the podcast. Thought it was really good. Cockpit Casual is one of my favorite things to watch on YouTube. And it's great to have some content from you guys in between. Steve, whereabouts are you from in South Jersey? This place is pretty special to me. I've got some family over there and I love it.
I am from, well, I currently live in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, about 15 minutes from downtown Philadelphia. I grew up actually in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on the west side of Cherry Hill, from fourth grade on. Prior to that, I lived in Northeast Philly, Northeast Philadelphia. So anyway, that's not your main question.
Go Birds.
Go Birds.
My question for you guys. So when you're taking these aircraft across the world, how do you keep the dailies valid? How do you keep the maintenance going on these things? Do you take an AMP with you or a mechanic of some kind, or do you guys do it yourselves? All right, thanks for all the good content, guys. Keep it up. See you soon.
All right, that was a fantastic question, and the Go Birds really made me proud, especially over the pond there. So the answer to that question is really, it depends. With U.S. registered aircraft operating under Part 91, there is not a requirement for a daily check unless it exists in the limitations of the SFP. The SFP is the special ferry permit. That is the document that is issued by a designated airworthiness representative or the FAA themselves that dictates the conditions that we can operate this aircraft on a specific route in within a specific window. And they could put in a provision for daily checks if they want to. They typically do not. The pre-flight checks that we do typically suffice. And so in those cases, nothing needs to happen more than a regular pilot pre-flight. That's on FAA registered aircraft. Foreign registered aircraft, foreign other than FAA registered aircraft, whether that be Guernsey, Cayman, Chile, Isle of Man, you know, Bermuda, one of the transients, or something that we're operating with validations on from somewhere else, or EASA, they operate on what you is they operate under a CAMO, a continuing airworthiness maintenance organization, and a CAMO assures that the aircraft is airworthy, continuing airworthiness throughout the validity period of the permit to fly, the PTF. And almost always those aircraft have some sort of checks built in because the PTFs are generally valid for more than just a specific flight. They're valid for like a window, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks or something like that. So whenever that aircraft is within that window of validity for the PTF, the permit to fly, it will require checks. Sometimes it's dailies, sometimes it's weeklies. It really depends on what the CAMO has put in there. And if there is a provision for checks, one of two things can happen. Our crews can be signed off as able to conduct the daily checks, which just means that we have to read and understand a task card, understand what each of the, it's basically a little bit more intense pre-flight check was what a daily looks like, oil and so on and so forth. Or we'll use one of our pilots that has an AMP, because sometimes an AMP is required. And if that is requested in advance, we can make that happen. Or we bring a mechanic along, a flying spanner along to conduct those. And we do hire those from time to time. I always prefer to have a mechanic aboard. I don't know. You too, assume, Bob.
No, definitely. It makes things a lot easier, especially if you have a problem.
Yeah. And it's someone else to talk to, fresh blood, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
they're usually help out with getting the airplane fueled. It just makes everything more time-wise more efficient.
Yep. And you know, there have been times, very infrequent, but there have been times where there have been dailies required, and we've just hired an organization that's already been pre-certified by Guernsey or whoever the registration is to conduct a daily check, and we'll just retain them. They'll be waiting for us in Belfast or in Shannon or in Malta or wherever we land, and they'll do the check and then we'll go. So that's how we address it. But more commonly, we don't have any type of daily checks beyond a pre-flight. I would say 80% of the 70 to 80% of the time we can conduct a trip without having any actual specific check.
Yep.
So, all right, let's see. I got
next.
Next. We're going to go all night here, man. I got so many of these things.
Oh my gosh. Hopefully they're not all technical.
I know.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Steve. How you doing? Just a question. If you've ever had the chance to ferry any aircraft from anywhere in the world to any destination, what would the aircraft be and where would you go and why?
God,
I mean, for me, it's really about like where we can make the most money. Maybe.
Yeah. An airplane.
I mean, the triple is my favorite to fly, I think.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. When I think about that question, I think about the finance side. I'm like going, whatever airplane burns the most fuel and is on the longest route.
Yeah. I personally am a big fan of Australia. I love Australia. I would probably, if I had to really answer this question specifically, I would say Sydney to Philadelphia, because we're right, so that way I don't have to take a flight home. Sydney to Philadelphia on a 777. Okay. Favorite airplane, favorite city to go to. I get home without getting on another airplane. Boom. Dream trip right there.
Yeah.
What about you, Bob?
Man, it's hard to say. When I think about the trips, I like island hopping across the Pacific. I love going into Guam and Majuro. And
with his shirt off.
Yeah. I love to think about doing that, but when I'm in the middle of that trip, I'm like going, oh my God, this is the longest trip I've ever been on. I want to get to the hotel and go to sleep.
And eat M&Ms. Oh my God.
But when I look back and see the pictures and things, you know, of those trips, they are my favorite. I love island hopping.
I do too. I love the Pacific. I love the Pacific. And the Pacific's easy because you don't talk to anybody.
Exactly.
HF position reports or maybe CPDLC, which is the data link, controller pilot data link. I mean, it's simple. You can do whatever you want and you're not going to hit anybody. You can kind of deviate however you want. It's just easy.
Yeah, I might have to say airplane and route. I would go back to like doing that 737-200 that we took out of, I don't know what, Tucson or something to the Philippines. And we had to island hop.
Man.
And each leg, we were like barely making it. We barely had enough fuel for each leg. And it was an old 200. I mean, it literally had like a little handheld Garmin. I don't even know if it was color screen or I can't remember. It might have just been a little black and white screen, and we're just following like dots across the Pacific. I don't know, man.
I got a picture of that trip. I got a couple pictures, man. So we're learning a lot about Bob and Steve here today. Bob is positive and upbeat, and he likes very difficult, like labor intensive trips. I'm a miserable bastard that just wants to sit back and not talk to anybody and not push any buttons.
Yeah, so that's the dynamic when we're flying together too.
Sometimes,
or sometimes it's opposite of that. I gotta say,
yeah, it does switch up. All right, what does Rick have to say?
Hello, gentlemen. Big fan. Love your videos. I'm very excited about your podcast. Quick question: why do you make your pit stops in Cairo versus, say, Amman or Cyprus or Tel Aviv?
Yep.
And would you ever consider taking a civilian on? Thank you.
All right. So
big fan.
Whoops.
Love your video.
We answered that one earlier, why we pick certain places. So I don't think that anything else.
Yeah, we
is
beat
really,
that to death.
Beat it to death.
Yeah.
As far as can we take civilians on trips? No. Most of the time we're operating on these special furry permits, these PTFs, SFPs. They are very, very specific that these trips are required crew only. So we can't even, I mean, we can't take anybody unless they're required for the safety of the flight. There are some exceptions. The exceptions are when we're flying an aircraft that's on a standard airworthiness certificate, it's very few and far between. It's usually aircraft that are in service with an airline already. And when we have those, yes, we can technically take passengers, but not without the permission of the clients, which they never give unless it's their own personnel.
Yeah, there's liability issues with, you know, insurance, liability, all of that. Not to mention that once we get somewhere, how are you getting back home?
Maybe he doesn't want to go home.
Maybe not. I mean, it's very expensive to, like, you know, fly back home from most of these places.
Yeah. All right. Well, I wish we could come in here.
I wish we could.
I didn't write down this gentleman's name, or maybe he did not provide it, but we're going to listen to his question.
Hey there, Bob and Steve. Thought that I should be early with some questions here. Recently, there was a taxiway incident with an SAS A320 flight from Brussels that ended up accelerating on the taxiway instead of the runway. Since you guys visit a lot of airports, should there be a better way for ground navigation? Second question, regarding headsets, it seems like you guys stick to the headsets on board instead of using something like the noise-canceling Bose A30s. Is there a particular reason behind that? Best regards from Olaf in Sweden.
All right, two-parter. First one, I'm not real sure how to answer. I mean, is there a better way to do things? I'm not familiar with that specific incident. Are you?
No, and I kind of wonder if it's one of those things where it was like a taxiway that leads into a displaced threshold before you, like, get to the runway, to where, you know, I've been mixed up a few times in those situations where it's like, I think I'm going towards the end of the runway, but
yeah, I would venture to guess that kind of probably the most dangerous part of a trip is maybe not safety wise, but like damaging an airplane wise is definitely taxiing.
Yeah.
I mean, you're moving around unfamiliar, especially us, like we're in places that we don't go to very often or sometimes ever at all. And it's easy to get mixed up. Like, when in doubt, stop. I mean, we get yelled at all the time, not because we do something wrong, because we stop before we do something wrong. And that's always the way you want to err on taxiing. Like, if I'm confused by an accent or by an instruction or something doesn't feel right or something doesn't seem right, I stop, I set the brake, and I wait for them to yell at me before I ask them what's going on, because it's better than bending metal. It's better than breaking a law.
Yeah, the better safe than sorry scenario. I will say that, you know, Korea, Incheon Airport, when you go in there, they have that light system to where it's putting
and in Abu Dhabi
green,
too.
Oh yeah, Abu Dhabi, they got that green light that you follow, and you know, if there's a red light, you stop. I mean, it's real simple, and but very effective and easy to taxi in that way.
Very good. Yeah. What was the other question he had? I forget. Hold on, I'll read.
Canceling Bose A30.
Headsets.
Yeah.
Okay, Bob wears the onboard headphones because there's something wrong with him
most of the time. So. It was what's fun. So I have the Telex, Telex that does have noise canceling. It's in my bag, but if I see a headset already sitting in the airplane, I'm just lazy and I'll just go, well, it's already plugged in, I'll just use that headset.
Yeah, it's as simple as lice. I don't want lice. I don't want like the sweaty, dirty, disgusting. God knows what's on the, like, have you seen what people's ears look like, Bob? Jesus, man. You're gross, dude.
I don't care. It doesn't bother me. I mean, I'll just put them on, whatever.
We're in dirty
old airplanes anyway.
I guess. I have a Telex Airman 8 or something. I gave that to Pat Lewis. I don't use that anymore. I normally use a David Clark, the small David Clarks that are made for like airplanes. I just like them. They're comfy. I also have the Bose ones that plug into your ears, but I don't use those anymore. And I do have Airmen, you know, like, we don't use those like big GA headsets like this. Like they're, I mean, we only wear headphones for like, you know, 10 minutes, like per flight.
Through 10,000 feet or something. Through 10,000 feet. Yes.
We take them off. The only other time I wear headphones is on a long haul. If I'm like, I have like, the reason I wear the David Clarks is they have Bluetooth. I'll watch a movie and like, when the radio talks, it like pauses the movie. Like, I mean, I'm not going to do that flying over Europe because there's too many interruptions, but like over the ocean where there's like no interruptions, you know, I'll hear a radio, you know, calm, but like it'll interrupt what I'm listening to. So anyway, that's the headset answer. What does Chris have to say?
Hi, Bob and Steve. My name's Chris.
Can you hear him, Bob?
From Houston, Texas, and I am a private pilot and also a member of Civil Air Patrol. My question for you is, what is your unicorn aircraft, either to fly or to ferry?
It's 777.
Boom supersonic.
No, I guess we can use stuff that doesn't exist yet. Oh, yeah, you win.
Is that unicorn?
Yeah. Boom. I should have been wearing my Boom supersonic hat. I'm going to wear it. I'm going to wear it on this next trip. I would say something like that. Concorde. Yeah. No, I'd probably kill myself in that thing.
Yeah,
the Boom supersonic looks easy.
Yeah, well, I guess I don't know. I'm probably too old. I'm never going to find out. I doubt I'm ever going to be ferrying one.
Come on, Blake's getting it done, man. It's going to happen soon. All right,
who knows?
Let's
right?
see. Yeah, James, what do you got for us?
Hi, Bob and Steve. My name is James Sutar. I'm a Canadian citizen who lives in Hong Kong, and I'm a PPL. Few hundred hours on Cessna 172. Been watching your videos for a long time. Really kind of intrigued about the whole ferry pilot stuff. And my question for you was, when I listened to all your type ratings, I'm not sure I heard if you, either of you, are type rated on one of the four engine aircraft like A340, A380, 747. Is there a reason for that? Is there not much demand for a four engine ferry, or is it just much more complicated? Yeah, just curious about four holer versus the two engine aircraft. Thanks a lot, and look forward to listening to more of your podcast. Ciao.
Yeah, both Bob and I are type rated on the A340, so we are rated on one four holer apiece, the same one, and we used to fly them all the time. I love that airplane. Actually.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, we've moved a bunch. We moved them to Kabul, to Amman, to. We took some out of Sri Lanka.
We've done quite a bit of flying, A340 flying, when they were kind of in their heyday of end of lease period and in that kind of ferry time. They've kind of grown out of that. They're not too many of them anymore. With the 747, the reason we never went and got 747 ratings, I've flown 747s for 20 years as an FO, but I never went and got the PIC rating because there's just not enough of them that move in the ferry world. It's just
and there's
few and far between.
Plenty of our pilots are rated on them. So it's just like, there's no real need. I mean, there's always been that little like nostalgic, like I've always said, if we like got a project where we had, say, you know, three or four in quick succession to do, I'd go down there and get the type and do it.
Yeah, it would be worth it.
I don't
know.
I'm kind of tired of like learning new airplanes.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, I'd love to fly the thing, but
it would. But
it's just not enough.
Yeah, I mean, if I get type rated on something, I want to go out and get good at it. I want to go out there and fly it enough to where I feel comfortable, you know, as a pilot in command on it. And,
yeah, the A380 is an impossibility for us. It doesn't exist in the U.S. register. Like, there's no FAA. Like registered A380s. There never have been. No U.S. airlines have ever operated it. And there may have, I think they put one on an NREG for a part out, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no U.S. pilots that have it on their FAA, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know how you would even get it.
I don't know. I missed the 707 era, sadly. I wish I would have flown the 707. Yeah, barely. I kind of wish I would have like at least gone out and got a type rating on one of those things a long time ago.
We moved some DC-8s with when you were Avia.
Yeah, I've moved some DC-8s. Just at that time, you didn't need an SIC to be a co-pilot in it. But I've jumped in the right seat of DC-8s and flown those. But
Bob
again,
is a three-holer guy, so he used to fly the MD-11.
Yeah.
And the 7.2.
Yeah, the 7.2, the MD-11, And we used to move quite a few DC-10s as well. The DC-10 was 5 years ago now, was a big one that would go into cargo conversion.
Yeah.
7.2 and the DC-10.
All right. Here's Jeffrey. I remember listening to this one. Jeffrey's a tech rep.
Hey, Bob and Steve, this is a great podcast. Nice surprise. Hey, you deal with a lot of maintenance reps, I'm sure. Maybe I'll interview with one of them sometime down the road just to kind of compare.
Definitely.
That's what I do for a living, but for a major airline. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Well, there wasn't really a question there other than we should have a tech rep on, and I fully agree. We will have lots of tech reps on. Most of our friends are tech reps.
Yeah. Yeah. Just for people that don't know, the tech reps are, you know, kind of project managers of sorts that do the, you know, get these return to services done, check records. We work hand in hand with the tech reps on all these projects.
Should we do some more, Bob? I got four more.
Yeah, why not? I mean, some of these might work, some of them might not. So just we might as well get a library of them.
Yeah. All right.
Hey, Bob and Steve. My name is Robert Cowan. I've been a big fan of Cockpit Casual since it came out, and it's really inspired a love for planes and aviation in me in these past 5 years. I'm in my mid-20s, have a perfectly fine job, but I've always had this itch to go out and get a pilot's license. And I was wondering if it's worth the time and effort, if I just make a full career change and try and become a commercial pilot, what are the best steps to do that? I see accelerated programs. I see programs sponsored by airlines. I see local flight schools, and I can't seem to find the best way to go about that. So any tips, tricks, advice would be great. Thank you.
Yeah. Well,
did he say where he's located? Is he in the U.S., you think?
Sounds like he's from the U.S.
Yeah.
So this could be a very long answer, and we want to help.
Get this on my Kitty Hawk app all the time, constantly. There's a lot of people talking about this on my app over there, either direct messaging me and asking me the questions or getting in some of the community groups and talking about it. But so just real quick, you know, my advice always is, if you're in this situation, is to don't quit your day job yet. Go out and, get a medical, make sure you can pass the medical. There's not going to be any issues there. Go out and start flying. Go do your private pilot license. Yeah. Get your private pilot license first. Just go through the process. Make sure that, you like doing it, and you're not going to have a problem with your medical, you know. Don't quit your day job yet. Kind of do think both in parallel initially until you're, know that you're ready, set, and not going to have any issues.
As far as being in your mid-20s, I mean, you're like way young. I know people that have career changed to aviation in their 40s, even maybe early 50s.
Oh, yeah.
When did Fred started, I think, when he was in his like early 50s. He was a cop. He had a full career as a police officer. And then he went and flew for JetBlue. Then he went and flew A320s for an airline in the Philippines. Then he flew A330s for that airline. And now he flies for us. He's been retired for a number of years, still flies for us. I mean, he switched over at an age that is older than I am now.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely doable from the 20s. I mean, you can still wait another 10 years and do it if you want.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could do anything in your 20s and recover from it. I mean, you could quit everything.
You can go to prison if you want.
This is true. You're going to recover from everything in your 30s, but that you do in your 20s. Take big risks in your 20s is what I tell everybody.
Yeah. As far as a path, there's so many different paths and you know, each has merits and each has downsides. And we're going to do an episode in the near future talking about flight training, and I'm going to bring my boys in who are currently in the process. I'm also going to bring in Pat Lewis, who was a CFI quite recently and who has friends that have gone through some of the airline specific programs. I mean, there's upside and there's downside to everything, from cost to time to is it really an advantage? I mean, some are, some aren't.
Yeah, quality of training, everything.
Yeah, and we both have a lot to say on this matter, so stay tuned. Reach out directly if you want. I can give you some advice. You know, if I'm feeling bored, I'll talk for on the phone with you. We'll figure something out. But yeah, it's something I want to address on the podcast soon. And we will. We're going to go into a lot of detail. And if you do want to make a career out of flying airplanes. I'm all for anyone getting into this business. If you love it, you got to do what you love. If you hate it, go do something else. I mean, it's just that simple. It's like people that are born to do it are born to do it. And some people don't know they are until they try it. So good luck, and more on that later.
Yeah.
Let's run a couple more of these questions here.
Hey, Steve. Hey, Bob. Raj from Florida. I was wondering how you quote and price a certain trip. Obviously, you don't have to talk about a real-life contract, but perhaps a made-up one. Let's say I'm an airline, and I want my A320, two of them, to be moved from Florida to China. China's responsible for it, or what the financial side of how things are planned and quoted, and what kind of contractual items are in place. Also, big fan of your work. Keep it coming. Thank you.
Man, oh, my God.
We'd be on here for the rest of our lives.
That's the detailed questions. That sounds like somebody that's trying to learn how to start a business like this.
Maybe. Look, we have very proprietary processes that we've developed over the years for doing this, but we could touch on some of it briefly. I think there will be times when we bring in members of our team, Chris Fochuk, who's our planning manager, who kind of he plans out all the trips for us. So we have some software that we've developed and some spreadsheets that we've kind of built up over the years to really help with that process. But you know, the first step is knowing what type of aircraft it is, where it's registered, what the mission is, the city pairs, you know, where it's coming from, where it's going. We immediately send it into, we put it into a queue on our system, and we have a bunch of internal processes. So when we place an aircraft in queue, it moves down a system kind of automatically after each person in our team does what they do, right? The travel person, the planning, the route planning, the dispatcher, the person who sources the ground handling, like we have all this. So we put it into the system. We put the key points on a line, you know, in a piece of software. You know, most planes go from one region to another. You have your China to Europe and your US to Europe and your US to Asia and Australia to Asia. We have preferred routing. So that part's pretty easy. There's only so many different types of aircraft, so we know where the stops are going to be. The whole routing process, unless it's like a Dash 8 going like 8,000 nautical miles, I can pretty much nail the route off the top of my head and say we're going to go here, here, and here, you know. And then we have price lists from vendors. We get updated fuel prices for each station. We calculate what the burn's going to be using average seasonal winds. We have software that determines the cost of the permits, the cost of the overflight fees. We know what the daily rate is for our crews. So we just take all these little components. It's probably 25, 30 components per trip. And we price it with actual costs and estimated costs. Some of the items are variable. Some of the items are fixed. And then we quote it. And then there are provisions for, you know, what is variable and what isn't.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, as far as the contingency stuff, like what ifs, you can't really plan for them. You protect that stuff with contractual language, like de-icing contingencies on certain routes, maintenance contingencies on certain aircraft. I mean, just our contracts have to be deep and rock solid so that when things come up, they're covered in the contract. Most of our clients are under a general terms agreement. So we have like this big master agreement that dictates how we do business with each other. And then each trip has like a specific, we call it an aircraft transport agreement, which breaks things down into specific scope for a trip, if that makes sense. So that's my answer. All right, we got two more.
How often do you encounter safety issues on the ground or in flight? I can imagine that ferrying planes at the end of their service life may carry some high risk of something going wrong, or maybe not. And do you have any crazy stories related to things going awry on the ground? For example, being stuck in Majuro or in the air? Thanks.
Oh, man. So not very often. Like, nothing. Safety, like, all right, let's break it down. Safety versus nuisance mechanical items. Nuisance mechanical items happen 30% of the time.
Yeah.
You know, some we can fix, some we can defer, some we can ignore, depending on where we are in the trip.
Yeah.
You know, if something happens on the last leg, it doesn't matter. If something happens on the first leg, we can either troubleshoot it or hire someone to fix it, or we can defer it. Major safety related issues are very, very rare, even in this side of the business, just because of the level of standard that the signers off, you know, take in their work, right? Like it's these airplanes are ready to fly when they say it. And if they're not, somebody screwed up, and people don't screw up very much. So we've had them. Yeah. I had a engine fire indication in a 7.5 over the Pacific 2 years ago. Shut one down, landed in Guam, was stuck there for a few days. We had an airplane have a bad APU in Majuro once, stayed there for a week.
And, you know, sometimes the route makes the difference. I mean, you may have an inoperative pack. You might start up the engines, go to take off, and you've got a pack you can't get on, or a bleed valve stuck, and you can't get a pack to come on, which, you know, you got two of them in most of the airplanes that we fly. So you want to have two. If you've only got one and it quits, you're going to depressurize. So you have to start making decisions. What kind of route am I flying? How far am I flying? Am I going to be way out over the water to where if I depressurize, am I going to have anywhere to divert to? Do I want to risk diverting to somewhere? Those are the kind of safety issues that like go through my head, you know, with equipment failures. I have to think about what's the route that I'm flying? What's the weather? Those kind of things. So it's always, you know, this, you know, variable decision really. I mean, yeah. Obviously, if you have an engine issue, you're not going to take off. Yeah. You know, I've had a few of those. Take off, you have a pressurization issue. We've had that a few times, or the gear won't come up, or you get some kind of gear problem that they didn't find.
Gear comes up and the light stays red. Like a gear door doesn't close all the way. Proximity sensors. There's always little stuff. Not always. I mean, there's little stuff, like I said, you know, 30-ish% of the time, but the major stuff like is really few, you know, knock on wood. I mean, it's
exactly.
we've been quite lucky with that. But it's not so much luck as it is that the processes are strong that our team and the teams of our clients follow. So
And it's gotten a lot better, like over the last 10 years or so. It's a lot better because the airplanes all seem to be newer.
Yeah.
Or at least I think maybe we've more evolved. Armed. Yeah, probably.
Like we've evolved as a company. Like our clients are more reputable.
Yeah. You like in the early 2000s, we could tell you some stories about, you know, repossessing MD-80s out of Africa. I mean, you know, I've almost killed myself a few times by doing stupid stuff that I wouldn't do anymore. But we're also not flying those kind of like junky airplanes either.
All right, we're gonna call it. But look, I love the I love these callers. Keep the questions coming, guys. I love dealing with all this stuff. I mean, it gives us stuff to talk about. It inspires stories to pop out. So keep them coming. That was a good round of questions. Yeah. Well, okay, guys. So we're gonna end the pod here. I just want to tease a couple of guests that we are going to have soon. Scotty Bateman, who just wrote another book, Jumbo, about the 747 and his experience with the 747. Scott's awesome.
He's just a great guy.
Yeah. Just so, so knowledgeable. He was also a RAF military pilot, C-130s. He wrote a book called Herc, which was great. So we're going to talk to him about both of his books. I think he really wants to promote Jumbo, but talk to him about his life and maybe try to get some more stories out of him. He's got plenty. And then Airplane Facts with Max.
Oh my gosh.
Wants to come on.
That's going to be so good.
I can't wait.
I've followed him for so long. I would have never believed that we would have him on this podcast. So cool. Hopefully,
I'm going to touch base with him this week, and Max is going to join the pod. That one might like end up, he might just have to like co-host for the day when he comes on.
Yeah. He's an interesting guy. Yeah,
he's great, man.
I mean, if you've never heard of him, you got to go find his social media channels. He's on a lot of them, and he's got some good stuff.
All right. We'll bring him on soon. It's been fun, Bob. Maybe I'll see you in Phoenix tomorrow. I don't know. I'm not going to be there till later in the day, but
yeah, I don't know. I'll probably be on the ground. I might be on the ground about the time you guys are arriving, actually. So
you can drive me to the airport.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Sounds
all right.
Good.
Well, I will hopefully see you in person tomorrow, and yeah, man, later.
All right. See y'all.